other organizations just adamantly bring in their siblings, their children come in, and it's not the most effective way to run a business.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. In this episode, we focus our attention on emerging markets and the leadership challenges faced by family-run businesses across the region. We're talking about third-generation family-owned empires that find themselves at the epicenter of Asia's growth story. Many are single-market success stories now vying for regional and, in some cases, global expansion. The question for many is how or even whether to take that plunge. It takes capital, grit, and perhaps most importantly, professional, if not world-class talent to go cross-border. It also means a move into markets without the advantage of political connections and cultural familiarity. By some estimates, family-run businesses make up 90% of the world economy. In Asia, such companies are the very foundation upon which national economies have been built these past 40 to 50 years. It's a proud tradition. But with the advent of global trade, technology, and fast-paced innovation, some family-run businesses are finding it hard to keep pace. Maintaining that family-run flavor and expanding beyond customary borders presents a whirlwind of challenges. To discuss this and more, I sat down in Singapore with leadership consultant and executive coach Bill Cornwell. Bill is the founder of Cascade Consulting and Professional Training. He also serves as a senior faculty member at the Center for Creative Leadership. He's been working in Asia for more than 15 years, and we started off by talking about his work as a coach to dozens of family-run businesses around the region, including Myanmar, a market left in the dust and shut off from the world for much of the past 30 years, and only now laying the commercial groundwork for growth.
Through my work with the Center for Creative Leadership, I'm on the senior faculty for them. I had the opportunity to be a co-facilitator in leadership development workshops for the Telenor Myanmar, which is Norway's leading telecom company.
And they recently, or 5 years ago, I believe, were awarded one of the licenses to operate a nationwide mobile phone network.
Yes, they were. Remarkably, there were 92 other telecom companies that bid on this. And through their process, they convinced the Myanmar government that you should select us. And they were the third company to get the license. They will be this year the number one telecom company in Myanmar.
And just to paint a picture for us on what Myanmar looked like around that time, I mean, it had been controlled by the military. Democracy was just burgeoning. There was still lots of resistance to a democratic state. It had been closed off to a large degree. It's probably one of the least developed countries in Southeast Asia. And yet, enormous natural resources, extraordinary potential, interesting positioning geographically within Asia.
Yeah. Consider the last big play in Asia Pacific, 55 million people, an energetic young population that wanted to get introduced to the world, and certainly Aung San Suu Kyi, she was sort of a guiding light for them for democracy. The generals are still there. They're behind the government. And interestingly, one of the most important positions with Telenor Myanmar is the government relations individual. The way they have to work their way through and create understanding with the government, and the way they connect with certain communities, different city governments, they take steps with great trepidation there.
So in effect, for Telenor, it was greenfield. You walk in, no infrastructure, very little or limited telecommunications infrastructure, no trained people to kind of operate, manage cell phones, cell services. They had to create it from from scratch. And this is where you and your experience comes in.
Yeah, absolutely from scratch. So they would bring in expats from some of their areas. But to their credit, they absolutely from day one had a plan to transfer as quickly as possible each position to the local Burmese population. And that still holds true. They really, really want to be able to do that. Their growth has been absolutely meteoric. They have over 7,000 sites now around.
Cell sites.
Yeah, yeah. They got to 95% coverage far faster than they ever thought they were going to do it. They will break $1 billion, U.S. dollars, in revenue this year. And if you look at the leadership capability, you would say this is a senior team that is really working hard, but I've seen more sophisticated leadership teams in billion-dollar companies before, and they're a pretty thin pool at this point. Mm-hmm. Eager. This is the critical thing to remember about Myanmar. When the moment you land in Myanmar and you get into your taxi or your car to go to your hotel, you can feel nation building.
How do you mean? Explain that.
Well, people are hustling on the street. It's very clean. There are people sweeping the streets. They're very proud of getting people to come and see their country. You can feel it in restaurants. The service is absolutely outstanding. And everywhere, from roadside eating stalls to fancy restaurants. They really want you to have a great experience when you're there. And that translates then into the leaders that I worked with in Telenor.
So they built the infrastructure, they put out these cell sites, they're kind of creating the engineers there, making sure that the system works. But we know behind every organization, it's the people that really make it happen. But they had a particularly unique problem, if I recall, which is they didn't have the people who were trained to do this because cellular services, mobile service providers in the country were new. So what did they do?
Well, they went out and just looked for people who were talented, people who were eager. An example, their head of brand is a medical doctor, somebody who's obviously smart, but could make more money in the telecom business and was just eager to learn. Their head of one of their regions is a veterinarian. Their head of in human resources was an air traffic controller in Singapore and wanted to come back to Telenor. So they got as much in the early stages, as much telecom experience as they could, but that went away very quickly because the government has a telecom company and there's a company out of the Middle East that was given a license also. So the pool was very thin to begin with for telecom. So they went out and hired good talent. But then at the same time, what you begin to notice as a coach and a leadership development person is that their understanding of leadership, their understanding of organizational structure was just as thin as their ability to understand what telecom was all about.
Yeah, non-existent.
Pretty much non-existent.
Yeah. Yeah. And what were some of these stories? I can imagine. I'm visioning, you know, a room full of 100 of these kind of mid-level managers who step in, big-eyed, ready to learn from all walks of life. What were some of the questions or some of the situations that you encountered that demonstrated their eagerness, but also their naivete?
Well, one of them was around in a workshop. We were talking about how to develop strategy and risk. And there was almost a silence in this group of people when I said the word risk. And I stopped and I said, well, let's talk about risk. What's happening with you guys when I say that? And they said, Bill, you have to understand that in the past, if we risked something, there was the potential that I would disappear. Or my family.
And when you say disappear, you mean removed by the military for saying or doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, no longer among us. Yeah. Or my family. Mm-hmm. So we are highly risk averse. Now, when you look then, how do you then get them to understand that you're in an entrepreneurial company? You've got to think of new ways, new innovative ways to interact with your customers, which is where your success is going to be. So there were a few bright lights that jumped up, and they now are moving through the organization. But it was a real awakening for me as a facilitator and as an executive coach, is how do you get them to slowly move towards taking that risk? So you had to work with senior leadership. So I'm coaching the senior team now, the 8 senior people. And that issue still comes up when I ask them, so how are you getting your direct reports to risk more than they have before? And it's starting to happen. Mm-hmm. They're feeling more comfortable that if they fail, they're not going to get fired or they're not going to be laughed at. In fact, Telenor expects failure. They want that to happen. But it's slow in coming.
It's interesting. It's almost like if you take other markets, more mature and people have been around in other organizations, through a coaching experience, you might have to unlearn habits, break down ways of doing things. In this case, being Greenfield, you can almost design, develop, and focus people as a unit to kind of think and work together, build relationship, because a lot of this is trust, isn't it?
Well, yeah, a great amount of it is trust. They really... want to know that their leaders have their back. I'll give you an example. Vos also had the opportunity to work with the senior team of GE Healthcare for Asia Pacific. And they're so sophisticated that they have a failure award every month. They're looking for the person who made the biggest mistake in the month. They announce it. And then they remediate it. They say, well, what could we have done differently? And they relish it. They're looking for it.
And they wish them good luck in their next company.
No. That's what they feel like would happen at Telenor if you did that, but not at GE. Yeah. They say, this is an opportunity for all of us to learn from this mistake. Yeah. Why did it happen? So if you're going to make that same kind of risk in your division, think about doing it in a different way. So it's a real learning opportunity. Mm. In Myanmar, and these young people who are just developing, they see it as abject failure. It's not something they're willing to risk to have happen.
And is that just time and experience is going to filter through to allow them to get there? And the idea that if they do fail, that they won't be pushed out or punished or disappeared?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a result of good leadership. Mm-hmm. Whether that leadership is the person from Myanmar who has now grown in the sophistication and taking over, or if it's with the top 2 or 3 people from Norway or from one of their other affiliates that have come in to head a certain area, they have to recognize that they have to allow these things to happen because it just takes time for that to develop.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. After the break, more with executive coach Bill Cornwell. We've been talking about the leadership challenges faced in emerging markets. Bill told me a story about a company he's working with in Sri Lanka, a group of 3 brothers, and how they've been working to make the transition.
It's a company called MAS, and MAS just stands for the first initials of the 3 brothers who started this, Mahesh, Ajay, and Sharad. Wonderful gentlemen. They're now all in their mid to late 60s, and they're very proud of what they've done. The organization has about 80,000 people in it. They produce finished clothing for the likes of Victoria's Secret, Marks and Spencer's, activewear for Nike, many of these things. And they have facilities now all over the world. So it's grown to the point where they came to CCL and said, we know that the next generation of people may be part of our relatives coming up. We're not sure. But we have a cadre of people that we want to develop more effectively. Now, this is an organization that has brought in lean manufacturing. They've brought in expats. This is a very, very sophisticated organization. Their leadership knows what it's doing. Facilities are world class, so they've interacted with the world in many, many different ways. But they sensed that what they were missing was getting leaders to really engage most effectively with their direct reports and more effectively with their peers. So our work was centered around the ability to develop leader coaches. And to their credit, they brought everybody they brought now 65 people have gone through this along with the board of directors, which included the three founders.
And the output is to basically create, professionalize the management and bring in best in class management styles and performance measures.
Yeah. And that's exactly what it is. But it's also having the ability then as a leader coach to coach people who report to you and get the best out of them. And they are trying, and I think successfully will over the next year to 2 years, changing from an I say you do culture to how should we do it better? How can we become more innovative? And creating that feedback culture, that coaching culture, that's looking for the younger people to tell them how to be more successful.
But what is it, because there's literally thousands of family-run businesses all across Asia, what is it that distinguishes those that understand the need to reach out and to change and advance themselves versus those that stick to what they've always known? Is it just personality traits? Is it exposure? Is it the nature of the business and their business partners or their clients?
Yeah, I think part of it is that some family businesses say, this is mine. This is my business. This isn't our business. To the credit of MAS, they actually say this is their business. Mm-hmm. We're older now. If our nieces and nephews, our children want to come in, we'll work with them to come in, but they have to protect their business. It's the company is, they don't see it as their company. Other organizations just adamantly bring in their siblings, their children come in, and it's not the most effective way to run a business.
Yeah. Let's talk about MAS within the context of Sri Lanka as an emerging market. We had said earlier that in the 1970s, it was really the jewel of Asia, one of those highest literacy rates, extraordinarily stable government, democratic principles. It was known as maybe the go-to market, but then it all fell apart with domestic violence and ethnic rivalry that kind of churned for 25, 30 years. That's now dissipating and Sri Lanka is starting to come into its own. What are some of the elements of Sri Lanka that intrigues you and how do you think MAS is going to capitalize on that?
Well, I think MAS sees that the future is really quite big for them right now. It's already big. They're well respected at what they do, but they also see a remarkably competitive kind of environment. So they want to be the company that is looking at dealing with the future. So it means how do we communicate with millennials? How do we get the next generation to be as successful as we've been in the past? And you're right about the ethnic issues, the Tamil Tigers, the revolutionary kinds of things that were going on. There is a great relief amongst the leaders and really amongst the people that I interacted with when I'm there that they're so happy that that's over because they do see a real bright future for the country overall. I think the fact that it's this huge island that they can control effectively what happens on that island. They're still trying to figure out who do we ally to. The Japanese have built this remarkable highway in from the airport. You could be anywhere in the world, in the best cities in the world, and you're on that highway. It's spectacular. But then there's also China wanting to build ports. The U.S. is there trying to figure out how they can support and be strategically involved with them. But the sense is that we have an opportunity to control our own destiny. And what's been fun for me as a leadership development person, executive coach, working with not just MAS, but a couple of other companies, is that all of these senior leaders recognize it's time for me to give back, not just to the company, but to the country overall. So Many of them are involved in governmental organizations. They've been asked to lead them. All of them are involved in charitable functions, having put together things 15 to 20 years ago for cancer development or something. They're very involved in wanting the people of Sri Lanka to be successful. It's an exciting time to be there.
Yeah. So there's kind of this institutional pride that's now demonstrating itself in ways that go beyond just running and building a big business. It's what can we give back to the country and how do we get ourselves back on the map, if you will?
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, in some developing countries, you see all the greed from the senior leaders. That's not here. They all know that they're well off, but they want everybody else to be well off. The way that they greet each other, there's such a great warmth amongst the people. There's great respect for each other. So it's an exciting time to be there. But they recognize from a leadership perspective, there's a long ways for them to go.
This is Steve Stein, and you've been listening to Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. My guest this episode has been executive coach Bill Cornwell. Thanks for listening. Now a quick look back at our discussion in the Asia Insider Minute, where I give myself 60 seconds, okay, sometimes it's 90 seconds or even a full 2 minutes, to offer some thoughts about what we've just heard. Here goes. First off, the topic of leadership succession tops the list. According to a recent McKinsey study, fewer than 30% of founder or family-run businesses survive past the third generation. It's understandable if you consider the charismatic leadership of family founders who built commercial empires from practically nothing, but then resist change or even adaptation as time goes on. Generational tension is evident everywhere, and some grandkids who might be in line for succession are simply opting out. When this happens, they're left with two choices. One, sell the business, or two, recruit outside talent. But that means moving away from a leadership model based on pure loyalty in exchange for one designed by process, reporting, and KPIs or key performance indicators. Can you hear the ripping and tearing of the family corporate culture? Second, Asia's family-run businesses are faced with a choice. Consolidate their grip on the home market through any means available, or go cross-border to build economies of scale. It's a precarious decision that could spell life or death for organizations grown comfortable in their own unique way of doing business. For those that do seek out new markets, it takes money and lots of it. Enter private capital. While it's true that many family-run businesses can leverage their own war chest to grow operations, most prefer outside investors to mitigate some of the risks. For some, it's like letting the fox into the henhouse. Private equity investors want transparency, financial clarity, and systematic approaches. Making changes to appease investors creates tension, and that's a problem for businesses that have traditionally defined success in terms of generational continuity. Thirdly, there's the knotty issue of appeasing grandpa. In Asia, filial piety is sacrosanct. Asia's largest family-owned conglomerates are headed by a plethora of octogenarians. Many have plans to stay the course straight to the grave. Others yearn to hand over the reins, but want assurances that the company will stay true to its original vision. That's not an easy promise in a time of rapid social, economic, and technological change. Just imagine for a second that dinner conversation between the 85-year-old tobacco tycoon and his 30-year-old granddaughter, newly minted with a Harvard MBA, and pitching the idea of transforming the business by trading out tobacco for renewable energy. It's a generational thing. Think of the millennials in your own family. Now amp it up about 1,000%. You get the point. These are heady days for Asia's family-run businesses, and those that can make the leap from old school to new era will likely be richer for it. Those that don't, well, there's always tobacco. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein, inviting you to come in from the outside on Inside Asia.